Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest.
Welcome back to Beyond Brunel. Today we're exploring one of the most pressing issues for us in the Southwest. How do we prepare for floating offshore wind? My guests today in the studio are Captain Richard Allen, Chief Exec and Hubmaster of the Port of Plymouth. And joining us online is Matt Hodson, Chief Operations Officer of Celtic Sea Power. It's great to meet both. Thanks for joining us. And here's a big question. Are Southwest ports ready for floating offshore wind? Richard, perhaps I could go to you first. It's quite something to frame. And so we'll start off and we'll kind of come back around and pick it apart. But do you think we're ready?
It's a massive question. And as we speak now, the quick answer will be no. But we are collectively as an area trying to get onto that graph just to make sure that we are doing what we can to be ready and to be able to support it in the future. But quick answer, as we speak as of today, it's horrible to say it, probably no.
Okay, that's interesting. We'll pull that apart in a second. But first I'll go to Matt. And so we've heard Richard's response. It doesn't sound overly positive. Can you be any more positive?
Well, I can certainly frame the answer in a positive way, which is no. I think the reality is that, you know, Richard is right. As we sit here today, we're not ready for the scale of the opportunity that's coming down the track. And that's not a bad thing, because there isn't anywhere in the world that's ready for the scale of this that's coming down the track. There's a lot of additionality here. You're talking about, you know, large scale industrial processes and, you know, large scale activity, which is not replacing something else. It's not like we've got an incumbent oil and gas industry here that needs to pivot. It is additional work. And our ports around the sort of Celtic Sea region exist because they have businesses to serve already. So the positive answer, I think, is we're not ready. But then why would we be? And perhaps we need to sort of look forward and ask ourselves the question, how can we be ready? And what exactly is it we're going to be ready for?
Fantastic. Okay, so there it's light at the end of the tunnel, basically. We're just not quite there yet. And of course, we've got some really significant targets which the government aiming for, something like up to 50 gigawatts of offshore wind to be deployed by 2030, and for floating offshore, up to 5 gigawatts by 2030. Really, really significant targets. So if we're to reach that, Richard, what do we need to do in, say, the next 5 to 10 years?
I quite like the use of the word we. Matt kept using the word we, and collectively as a Southwest, it won't be just Plymouth or Falmouth or Portland. It will be a we, I think, to reach those targets. It will be everybody working together through organisations like Matt's. And actually, everyone's got strong points that another port hasn't got, and vice versa. And collectively, we need to work together and be able to facilitate to actually meet these demands that are going to be set by the government.
And Matt, perhaps we should just kind of break it down in terms of the way in which floating offshore wind is deployed. So correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is there's kind of operations and maintenance to consider, but also the rollout itself, so the transportation and the installation. And so I wonder, how can we gear up our Southwest ports for both of those different types of operation? Or is it that we just focus on one?
It's worth getting into the weeds on this a little bit, because, you know, if you start with the operations and maintenance part of floating offshore wind, it's going to be different to what we've experienced in the fixed wind industry. If fixed wind is categorized as essentially an offshore marine civils project, so you build it and then thereafter you go out and visit it to maintain it, floating offshore wind is probably realistically going to have far more of the maintenance done in sheltered waters and or alongside. I'm an ex-mariner. Richard's still a mariner. I don't want to speak for Richard, but until they invent the skyhook, I struggle to see a safe way of doing large component maintenance offshore in the sort of sea areas that you're going to deploy floating offshore wind. So that's going to require a need to tow assets to sheltered waters where work can go on. The balance of plant associated with floating offshore wind, your moorings, your inter-array cables, are a significant maintenance item in and of themselves. If you think about the moorings for the Celtic Sea for the first 4.5 gigawatts, you're talking well over 1,000 mooring lines, well over 1,000 seabed fixation anchors. You know, those things do not last 25 years without some form of maintenance. So, I mean, that's a 30, 40, 50 year requirement. And what we do need to be thinking as a collective, as an industry, is, well, how do we deal with that? Because the type of infrastructure and assets you need to deal with that are going to be the same sort of infrastructure and assets you need for the sort of installation phase. There are a number of areas that there is the fabrication of the structures, some the fabrication of the turbines and towers, the logistics associated with bringing that to an integration point, port, the integration and commissioning, offshore wet storage is going to be essential. And then the sort of, you then the tow out and install. And then all of those balance of plant items, moorings, anchors, interray cables, all of the jewelry and components that go with that that need to be stored. When you look at the quantities and the scale, it becomes really clear that there is no one single port that can do it all. So, you know, we need to have a strategic operational plan that we all buy into and which is deliverable. And that's something that I think is, you know, that we need to kind of get to fairly rapidly, you know, within the next 6 to 12 months. We need to kind of understand what that is. That's something that requires collaboration, coherence, and coordination.
Okay, so sounds like a bit of a challenge then, Richard. As a port, you've got a challenge to work with others, it sounds like, from Matt, to come together and to make this reality. How do you go about doing that? Are the ports already speaking to each other?
Great question. Yes, but not at the level we need to be talking to each other, I think. We know what our strong points are. We know what our weaknesses are. I think all ports are now working hard with the local authorities to get them on board to make sure they realise the opportunity here. I think the opportunity here is vast. We need to make sure our ports are part of this. You know, I think what we'll get out of this as a port and a city and as a southwest is far superior to any free port or any other big investments recently. This is huge for the area. So we have to speak on that level. Plymouth, you know, we know what we can do. We know what we can't do. So I'm not going to start saying we're going to be lifting out a shard every 36 hours out to the southwest approaches, but we know where we can support and facilitate parts of these operations.
And is it that we need to bring in people from different areas, skills from different areas, or can we keep it within the region, do you think?
I think there's a vast amount of expertise already in the Southwest, just locally within my team. You know, my background is subsea construction. My pilots, they've worked for the biggest offshore wind contractors in the world for years as masters, and that's their role. But strategically, I think obviously there will be expertise to be brought in and bring everybody together. Do you agree with that? I think we have got expertise, but it will have to be supplemented going forward.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's probably the perception thing, but if you look at the foundation we have in the Southwest, our maritime and offshore capability is exported right around the world. In fact, some colleagues of mine spent a week in the Northeast, in the Hull and on Tyneside, talking to some of the big offshore developers in the fixed wing game, looking at how they deal with marine coordination and offshore. And the comment was that the majority of the offshore crews were coming from the Southwest. And so this region has a very strong foundation and very capable people, very capable companies. I think where we have a sort of slight issue moving forward is balance sheet capability. So, you know, we're talking about multi-billion pound industry, and very quickly we're going to find ourselves in a situation where the contract sizes are going to be in the hundreds of millions, which makes it very difficult for SMEs to sort of compete as prime contractors. So track record, I think, is tier two, tier three opportunities. I think there is a fantastic opportunity whilst there are no big incumbent contractors. You know, nobody has yet built an offshore wind farm bigger than 80 megawatts. So there is no incumbency right now. So there's some great opportunities for the UK to ask itself the question, how much of this industry do we want? And what can we do to de-risk the capital which will be needed to plug that balance sheet gap, if you like? And it'll be centered around our regional ports. I think, you know, the reality is that, you know, this stuff needs to happen close to site. So we are close to site. It's going to happen here. And so, yeah, some real opportunities. And, you know, it will probably require an augmentation of what we've already got. I think intelligent partnerships, targeted inward investment pitches, and an adult conversation about who should we be partnering with, who should we be bringing into the region, and how do we maintain some ownership of it as we go forward. But yeah, don't underestimate the strength and power of our marine and maritime and offshore capabilities in this part of the world.
It's interesting, Matt said the crews in the Northeast, so many of them come from the Southwest. We are training hundreds of people working in offshore wind down here in Plymouth already. I spent years flying from Plymouth, Manchester to Aberdeen to work offshore in the North Sea. It still happens, obviously no airport anymore, but that commute of offshore experience from the Southwest up to that Northeast is massive. We are training the workforce and we've got those skill sets. We're already in that industry. It's just keeping them here in the next few years.
So we have the location, we've got the skills, we've got the people, albeit we're exporting some of those skills because we've got it here and we can do so. But I'm wondering, in terms of floating offshore wind and the effect it's going to have on our ports and different types of industries, are we at risk of treading on other people's toes? I'm kind of thinking about fishermen and different industries in the Southwest, energy industries, tidal, that sort of thing. What do you reckon, Richard?
Locally where we're based, no, I don't think it will be, because we'll be in a supporting role and maybe a sort of mid-level role. It won't be stepping on anyone's toes. Matt's already touched on the point that if floating offshore wind did come base in Plymouth, you know, we've got 2 million tonnes operating through our docks. Is the private customer who owns the wharf facility going to say goodbye to an old customer for the guarantee of offshore wind? Yes, but at the moment, they haven't got any guarantees like that. So stepping toes commercially, potentially, will be on the horizon. And that's where you'll need government support and policy to make those big decisions. You know, fishing-wise, that's more for like the marine protected areas off the South Coast approaches, won't specifically affect me. Matt might be able to expand on that.
I'm interested. You picked up on a point about the maintenance period for floating offshore wind, something like 25 years. Presumably, we're going to have an awful number of floating offshore structures which are coming to the end of their life in 25 years' time. If we're needing to accelerate our deployment, does that mean we're going to be stuck in 25 years? We've got an awful lot of these structures which need to be bought in and replaced. How does that work in terms of the logistics of it?
That's an excellent question. And I don't think anybody's got the answer at this stage. So end of life for wind, full stop, is a very live area of research and development. You've got fiberglass blades and what have you, which are potentially difficult to dispose of. So there's a general kind of theme of dealing with end of life of the sort of turbine and technologies. The floating structures are an interesting one. You can foresee that you could design and build your foundations with two repowers in mind, i.e. the leases are likely to be for 50 years to allow for 25 years for your first project and then another 25 years for a repower. It is possible for floating structures to last 50 years. I think all the ships I ever sailed on were that old. I don't know. It was a while ago. But there is that sort of potential for kind of reuse. Then you have an interesting commercial conversation about, are you over-engineering a structure for a 50-year life when you actually need to have it paying back in 15 years? So, yeah, that sort of decommissioning, reduce, recycle, end-of-life conversation is one that probably isn't particularly well advanced or particularly mature, but in as much as we need to have that operations and maintenance period kind of well understood, then I think you need to have a pretty good view of that decommissioning period as well. It impacts on your levelized cost of energy calculations, which what drives, you know, the price of wind power essentially.
Presumably it's something we're gonna have to think about pretty quickly if we're rolling out these turbines before 2030.
I wonder if there's a comparison to the North Sea. I wonder when that boom happened with oil and gas, because it's big business now, the decommissioning in the North Sea out of Aberdeen, northeast ports. I wonder if they knew what they'd be doing now when that boom first started all that time ago.
And presumably the decommissioning of floating offshore wind structures, turbines, is as much of an industry as the installation, transportation setup.
You could argue it's more, Matt, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Taking your point, Richard, you look at how much money is being spent on decommissioning of offshore oil and gas assets. And there's a whole new vessels and techniques that have grown up around sort of floatovers and removing topsides, which, and then this is oil and gas at the end of its cycle. So the money's been made already. So I guess no one wants to spend money on that bit of the industry. But yeah, I think potentially when you start to kind of try and get your head around that, it does make the fabrication and assembly and integration look quite easy, because the reverse of that is decoupling and then trying to break up large structures, which may be concrete and they may be steel. And how do you deal with that? And where do you deal with that? It's a really interesting angle.
And Richard, just in terms of the Southwest and bringing it back to our region, what do you think at the minute the key obstacles are? What are the biggest risks? Is it purely the infrastructure or is it around policy? What's your take on that?
On a local level, everyone would agree with me. It's the infrastructure and space. You know, we don't have the space that other regions have, acres of, not wasteland, but, you know, unused space. We don't have that because people want to be at the coast here facing the sea. We're very affected by that in Plymouth, and we're not pushing back now, but we're trying to get the local authority to think strategically around the port area to facilitate the future such as this. But infrastructure, you know, a lot of the commercial docks and wharfs are Victorian design. Problems we've got 50 years ago, we'd have three or four ships in one of our docks. Now we've got one vessel in that dock sticking out by 30 metres. And the draft of these anchor handlers that, you know, I used to work on, the same drafts of the vessels, tankers that are coming into the ports, the infrastructure's dated. And the space around that infrastructure is two weaknesses that we're working hard on to get local authority support and regionally to support this going forward.
Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest. From the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn. Follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest.
Matt, if you had one ask of our key leaders in the region, what would it be?
So I think it has to be coordination and coherence, and coordination around interventions, and potentially the interventions need to be at sort of a national level, but, you know, there's influence from the region. You know, we've talked about infrastructure being a barrier, and it is. If you factor in ports and grid, those are the two big infrastructure areas that are essential. You cannot build an offshore energy generating business without them. There's no shortage of capital willing to invest in these infrastructure projects, but the barrier to getting that capital in to enable these, you know, major projects to push forward is that lack of certainty, revenue certainty. You know, we've got big targets, big pipelines, big leasing competitions, but those project developers won't sign contracts with the contractors who will pay for the port services for another, you know, 6, 7, 8 years at least. So in that 6, 7, 8 year period, we need to have strategically planned what we need in terms of upgrades. We need to have got consents. All the ports need improvements and need new infrastructure. You need to get through that consenting process, get the public on side, start putting a spade in the ground and be ready. And at the moment, it's massively speculative, because then the offshore wind developers might just pull the plug because, you know, the prices have changed, which has happened on the East Coast in the last 4 months. So there has to be a sort of coordinated de-risking policies and mechanisms in place to ensure that we can, you know, push the button on these infrastructure upgrades. My view, and it is a personal view, is that port investment should be no regrets investment for a country. These are strategic assets. I think Richard alluded to the fact that there's quite a lot of Victorian infrastructure out there. That Victorian infrastructure has been serving and servicing and, you know, actually driving, you know, the economic needs of the region for 150 years. So if we build infrastructure now, notwithstanding what happens with floating offshore wind, it'll be servicing and driving the economic needs of the region in 100 years' time. So how do we use this market pull of a big opportunity on our doorstep, coupled with some de-risking policies, to make these infrastructure improvements a no regrets, no-brainer decision? At which point our regional leaders would probably be bored of my ranting and have wandered off, but at least I would have tried, hey.
So we've got everything going for us in the Southwest, but I'm wondering, Richard, do you think the public are really aware of floating offshore wind? And equally, do you think they're aware of the untapped potential we've got in the region?
The awareness of the public, I don't think, is at the level that we know. We're involved in it. We're working hard. I don't think the public are aware. You know, we're a port city. Other than local authorities, I don't think the city of Plymouth is aware of the opportunities that are on our doorstep. We're doing a port master plan at the moment, and we've used some UK shared prosperity funding, like other ports in the Southwest have, to do feasibility works to look at future developments, and that's ongoing as we speak. Part of that port master plan is really to engage with the city and show the city the opportunity for green jobs, jobs as a whole, maritime, and the opportunities that are fast approaching the Southwest, and we've just got to make sure we're part of that.
And Matt, I'm conscious that you mentioned that the towing of these structures was an important part of floating offshore wind. And so if we're going to be towing components out to sea, then is it that we can use our local skills and resources to contribute to that work? I'm conscious that Plymouth University, they've got a ship simulator. And so my thought is that they could be modelling this type of stuff. Is that something that you're aware of?
Absolutely. I'm very proud of the new DP simulator in Plymouth. It came out of a project that we led called Cornwall Flow Accelerator. And the guys there are doing some amazing, amazing research, looking at, you know, the impacts of towage, looking at the thrusts and the fuel consumptions that are required to provide an evidence base which should support the design of the next generation of low carbon vessels to meet this need. I used to sort of cough over my cornflakes a little bit when floating offshore wind was first being mooted, because we used to hear that, you know, the advantages are that it can be built in ports and then towed out to site using harbour tugs. And you just think, well, no, you would never tow these things using harbour tugs. They're designed to do a different job. And in fact, they are busy supporting and serving the harbours, which they are sat within. But I think there's a dawning realisation across the industry that actually the marine assets needed to support this industry are going to be new. And it'll be an industry in their own right. There is a anchor handler shortage coming. It is about 4 years away, and there will not be enough of the larger anchor handlers available to support what is a global requirement. So again, therein lies some opportunity. My personal view is that if you're talking about, you know, developing a marine spread to last for 25 years and you're looking at it right now, you're talking about ships being built for the 2030s. You shouldn't be thinking diesel. And so again, that's the big thrust actually for this part of the world. Clean marine is a big deal, something University of Plymouth and University of Exeter are both on top of. So yeah, again, it's a market pull of a big opportunity which supports wider benefits and impacts which we can really benefit from.
And Matt, where are we on the curve in this in terms of other regions? You know, are we ahead? Are we behind? How are we performing?
It depends what your metric is, Chris. If you take a look out into the Celtic Sea at the moment, there are 0 megawatts being generated. So one would argue that we're probably behind Scotland that's got 2 floating offshore wind projects deployed. However, those floating offshore wind projects that were deployed out of Norway for the first one and Rotterdam for the second one. So they didn't really touch the sides in Scotland. I think actually in terms of our strategic thinking, I think in the way that we collaborate with each other and present a united front across the region and also in Wales, we're hand in glove with our colleagues in Wales on this. I would say we are ahead of the curve. We're ahead of the curve, I think, in that we have a good, honest understanding of the barriers and challenges that face us. And I would put us up with Norway in respect of where we are in terms of our understanding, where they are in their terms of understanding. We should be slightly concerned of is Norway is probably ahead of us in terms of how they're going to export the final solutions, whatever those final solutions might be. So, yeah, I'm a bit of a glass half full optimist, and I think we're in a good, positive place. But we need to turn that understanding into delivery, I think, is probably the next kind of phase, really.
And Richard, what are your thoughts on that?
I actually agree with some points that Matt said there. I think we're on the curve for the frontline tier one, the infrastructure, the actual marine operations. And that's where the real work is starting now, collectively in ports and throughout the region. But where we're ahead of the curve, and I think it's a really big selling point for what the Southwest does, is look at the autonomous vessels that are now operating in offshore sites around the world with renewables. They were tried and tested in Plymouth, signed off in Plymouth. We've got some big customers down here in the Southwest. We've got, you know, the home of autonomy in Turnchapel Wharf. We've got Exeter Uni. We've got Plymouth University. Exeter University is working hard on the clean propulsion, the world leading unit there at Exeter Uni. Plymouth's got the offshore simulator. So when we're hosting offshore clients from Europe, you know, we make sure we take them to the university, because what we've got supporting that front line is brilliant. And I really do think we are ahead of the curve from technology, academia, the science and the training of the staff that goes on here in the Southwest working offshore. It's second to none. I'll be surprised if anywhere can match that. Well, in the country, we're well ahead on that curve, but the front line of getting those anchor handlers in with 8-meter drafts and transporting those thousands of meters of chain, we're on that curve. Wouldn't say we're ahead of the curve.
But that sounds really positive, and it sounds like already academia and industry are working together. So I suppose the next question is, who is the next piece of the jigsaw that you need to add to collaborate with? Who can make this happen?
For me, it's the commercial operators and the port authorities and government. It's going to have to be government inputting at what level. It's probably a little bit above my pay grade. I'll have to speak to Matt before I answer that one. But, you know, that is the strategic level, what we know we have to facilitate to support part of offshore wind.
Okay, Matt, question for you then. We've got industry, we've got academia, both working together. Who else do we need?
So I think it's capital. We've got industry and academia working on solutions. We've got port authorities, port operators tackling, you know, their master plans and development requirements. We all know we need to collaborate, coordinate, and there needs to be sort of a strategic overview to make sure that all of the parts work together. At some point, that's going to be underpinned by contracts, big contracts led by developers, and underpinning that is the capital. I suppose the big barrier to kind of really unleashing that is the timing problem between the market being ready to sign big contracts and the need for investment to have the solutions ready ahead of time. And so that's the piece of the puzzle which is missing. It's that coordination. And it's probably a coordination at a policy level, backed up by coordination at a de-risking interventionist level as well.
So, Matt, follow-on question. Can the Southwest be the first region to roll out offshore wind? And what does it mean at a policy level? What change do we need to see?
So taking the first part of that question, can the Celtic Sea be the first region to roll out floating offshore wind? Well, Scotland already has floating offshore wind projects. However, you know, within the Celtic Sea, we've got leases for 432 megawatts of projects already under development, with a 4.5 gigawatt leasing round due to launch imminently. We face a lot of the challenges that other regions do around infrastructure and grid, but I am quite confident that in some of those areas, it is relatively easier. And I use that term very loosely because nothing is easy. So whilst we might not be the first region to roll out floating offshore wind, I do genuinely believe that we have an opportunity to be the exemplar region for the industrialization of floating offshore wind. The processes, the services, the products and the technologies and the business models that will need to be developed to build floating offshore wind anywhere in the world need to be done first somewhere. And I think that should be our ambition. And it is a big ambition. It is very ambitious. But the UK definitely should be aiming for that. And we as an exemplar region would want to play our part in doing that. If we don't, if it happens somewhere else first, then that's how it will be done forever. Fixed wind, that's what happened. Once it's been done, because of the scale of investment and the conservative nature of the investment, there is very much a, we want to do it the same way we did it before because the perception of risk is much lower. That is why the UK, which until very recently had the world's biggest portfolio of offshore wind, it's only just been overtaken by China, but until very recently, it was the world's largest portfolio of offshore wind, has about a 5 to 8% market share in the export market globally. How has that happened? How have we found ourselves in that position where big industry on our doorstep, and yet, you know, we are not exporting in that marketplace? So it becomes actually pretty crucial, I think, for our long-term sustainability to do that, to industrialize first. So that's where we can be first. Taking your second point, what does that coordinated policy action look like? Good question. Slightly above my pay grade. What I can say is there obviously are a number of different government departments that with portfolios that touch this. They're all talking to each other, but still, you know, they've got their own ministers, their own policy drivers. They've all got to dance within what the Treasury sets them. You know, there's only so much money to be spent. And I think the interface risk there is friction, I suppose, which potentially slows things down.
Work to be done, but with insight.
Yes, absolutely.
I've been shown some recent documents that the French government have done about their ports and their maritime industry and how they're so supportive of it. And they're actually publishing documents about the ports and why we need to dredge and what it brings to the country. And it's just interesting seeing the French government stepping up and actually pushing their maritime cities and ports and what it means for them. And I think it's going to be on that sort of level here, Britain as a whole. This is what we want to do. Let's get everyone together to achieve those goals.
I'll just add to that. I don't know what you think, Richard. I think as an island nation, we're incredibly maritime blind and have been since I ran away to sea in the 80s. It's always felt that the opportunities that arise from our marine, maritime, offshore energy industries almost sort of slips below the radar when it comes to the public and potentially policymakers that represent the public. It might just be a personal view, but it's always felt a little bit like that.
No, it's a widespread view and it's very true. And I don't know why, because, you know, economy-wise, if you're working in maritime, I think your wage is 40% more than that area that you're working in. It's of such a positive industry to be in, but we are maritime blind.
Yeah.
So I suppose the takeaway is to champion the work we're doing in offshore wind, floating offshore wind in particular, to champion our ports and to champion the good work we're doing in the Southwest. We're almost out of time, but that brings me back to our question of, are Southwest ports ready for floating offshore wind? And Matt, I'll come back to you first. Has your view changed or is it the same?
I would say our Southwest ports are ready for action.
That's a great response. And Richard, I'll come to you. Are Southwest ports ready for floating offshore wind?
The Southwest ports at the moment are working hard to be ready to achieve the goals set by what's going to happen in the Celtic Sea wind.
Fantastic. Loads of takeaways from that. It's been a great discussion. Thank you very much again, Captain Richard Allen, Chief Exec and Harbour Master of the Port of Plymouth. And thanks, of course, to Matt for joining online as well. Matt Hodgson, Chief Operations Officer of Celtic Sea Power. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Beyond Brunel from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn. Follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest. Beyond Brunel is presented by Christopher Ackland, a Fresh Air Studios production.